Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Hello, and welcome back to Venus Rising. I'm your host, Callie Fell. I have had the opportunity to talk with so many wonderful people this season, and today is no exception. Today, I have the privilege of sitting down with Rachel, a 31-year-old detransitioned lesbian, here today to tell her story. Rachel lived for 5 years as a trans man taking injectable testosterone, but stopped medical transition 4 years ago and quickly ceased identifying as transgender. She became popular on Twitter for being outspoken about the long-term health effects of cross-sex hormones and transition-related surgeries. She's done several interviews regarding the topic, and though she's no longer active on Twitter, you can find her on Medium under the handle at Habitually Femme, and that's at HABITUALLYFEMME. Rachel, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to join us on Venus Rising.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So before we dive into your story, and I do want to kind of warn listeners a little bit that this could be a triggering story. Rachel and I have talked a little bit through email. So if you have littles around, maybe pause it and come back to us when you have time to listen to this for mature audiences. But before we dive into your story, do you mind telling listeners what detransitioned means or is? I think a lot of people have heard the word transition, but what is detransition?
So detransition, it usually implies that you are going back on your transition process. So more specifically, people in the detransitioned community, we define ourselves typically as having done some sort of medical thing to in order to transition. So for me, it was cross-sex hormones. For others, it may be a surgery of some kind in addition to hormones usually. But the place where it gets a little bit foggy is there is detransition and there is desisting. Now, desisting is when someone has not taken any medical route to transition, however, has socially transitioned. Started, you know, going by another name, identifying a different way, dresses a different way, but has stopped there and then has gone back. So they stop dressing a certain way, stop using, you know, a name associated with the opposite sex and start identifying as who they were before they began transition. Detransitioners, like I said, it's more medically related, but also we have that same process where we stop our medical transition and then we also begin identifying usually as the person we were before we transitioned.
I see. Are there a lot of people who kind of decide to go back or detransition?
So the number is really pretty much unknown. There have been a couple of surveys. However, a lot of the times those surveys are a little bit too open. They're usually done through social media with very few ways to vouch for the legitimacy of those people doing the survey. So there are people who are trying to get actual numbers, but there's been some resistance from people who are in favor of transition, who say that we don't need to know the number because we are, detransitioners are a minority, so we don't need to know, which seems kind of counterintuitive to me because if we're such a minority, we should probably know. But I would say I've met a good over 100 detransitioned people, and that's not including people who desisted. If I were to include people who desisted, I would say about 200 people I've met.
Really a small number considering that the trans population is also a minority. So not insignificant, which is interesting because I feel like you don't often get to hear your voice or, you know, your collective voice. So thank you again for being willing to be a voice that can be heard. So let's jump into your story. Can you briefly tell us about maybe what was it that made you believe that you were a man or that you wanted to start down transitioning and why it was that you wanted to transition? Just to kind of talk us through your process, and you can, again, be as brief or as detailed as you'd like during this. I know it can be painful to talk about.
Yeah, sure. So I will say straightforward, you know, my story has a lot of nuance and a lot of factors, and a lot of detransitioners are the same way, where there's more than one reason why we decided to transition, and there's more than one reason why we decided to detransition. So for me, it was a little bit complicated, but mostly it surrounded around my discomfort with being seen as female. I had less discomfort in regards to my actual anatomy and more discomfort with how my body was treated in the world. So I have a long history of sexual abuse, both from family members as well as other people. And then in addition to that, I've struggled a long time with my sexual orientation. Those two factors played a really big role in not wanting to be seen as a woman. I didn't want to not be seen as a lesbian because there's so much affiliated with that. But I also didn't want to be seen as a woman in general because I'd experienced so much abuse. I wanted to escape. I came to find out what transition was and how one would identify as transgender through someone I met on a blind date, actually, who was transgender and did not disclose this to me.
Okay. That was my next question was, did you know when you were going on a date?
I did not. This person was, and again, I'm being very specific here. Obviously, this does not apply to everybody.
Sure.
But this particular person was extremely aggressive about me not being attracted to them and found ways to kind of cause doubt within myself. So some of it was, you know, they told me I couldn't be a lesbian if I wasn't willing to date a trans woman. And that kind of confused me. And they called me a bigot and they told me I didn't even act like a woman. So I had no right to judge them for their body because I didn't even act like a woman. And then that escalated to, you don't act like a woman, you're not a lesbian, you can't be a lesbian, you're actually a man. And a person who's stable might take that and that kind of critique and be able to come back at it saying, no, I know myself and you're wrong. But I was not stable. So I kind of took all of that to heart. And since I really was questioning my orientation and myself at the time, I started to think, you know, if I don't act like a woman and I don't feel comfortable being seen as a woman, maybe I'm not a woman.
Wow. You kind of broke up there in the middle. And so I just wanted to repeat what you said just for our listeners. So you were saying that the two things together, kind of your sexual orientation and your trauma and sexual abuse as a woman, are the two things that kind of fueled this idea that you might be the wrong sex.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Just broke up a little bit. I just want to make sure that that was clear. So you have these doubts, you start down the road. What does that look like for you? So you did go on to testosterone. Were you, what were your order of events, so to speak? Were you already seeing a therapist? Were you already seeing a medical provider? How did you start?
It happened really fast. And that's one common thread amongst detransitioners is we will tell you, generally speaking, most of us, it went really fast. So for me, I started seeing a gender therapist, and they are very different from a generic therapist or a therapist who specializes in depression or anxiety. They tie everything to gender identity.
Gotcha.
So any mental health issues you're experiencing ties back to gender identity. Now, I will say, this kind of makes me nervous. I don't talk about it that much. But when I was a teenager, I was diagnosed with schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I've kind of had to live with and deal with for a long time, trying to navigate my diagnosis and find stability there. At the time I was seeing my gender therapist, I was not stable.
Gotcha. Do you think you would have received better care or advice, or had you chosen a therapist that wasn't specifically for gender therapy?
I look back and I really wish I had seen pretty much anyone else.
Yeah.
I feel like the care that I received was very insufficient and harmful.
And then once you started seeing the therapist, is that when you started kind of going to medical doctors for the prescriptions for the testosterone or?
Mm-hmm. So I saw my therapist three times. And by the third time, she had signed a letter stating that I consented to go along with medical procedures in the future and that I was mentally sound of mind. Again, I was not, and this therapist was perfectly aware of my mental health history. It was all documented. And then that same week that I had that third therapy appointment, I had an appointment with a primary care physician who also was experimenting with diagnosing people with gender identity disorder, as it was at the time. It is no longer diagnosed that way, but that's what it was at the time.
Did you, at the time, I mean, now you can look back, right? Hindsight's always 20/20. But at the time, did you feel heard? Did you feel empowered? Or did you have doubts? What did you feel going through meeting with her? At three times, that seems very quick. I agree.
Yeah. And like the time from when I first saw the gender therapist to when I got my actual prescription for testosterone was about a month and a half. So yeah, I initially I felt elated. I felt really euphoric because, you know, I'd been struggling with so many mental health issues in addition to just such a detailed history of issues. And it felt like this was the resolution. This was going to fix everything, you know?
Yeah.
And when you're desperate, you'll reach for anything.
Mm-hmm. And you want to fit. I mean, I've, you know, it's like, even when you have like a weird stomach ache or a weird ailment, you just want to find, right, like what's causing it. And it's so much relief when you're like, oh, this is what's causing my pain and suffering. And so for you, I can imagine, you know, it's mental health, which is still part of our health. So it's like, oh, this is going to fix it. It's interesting. In our new documentary that we just put out, Transmission, What's the Rush to Reassign Gender? We talk the whole movie is about children transitioning. And one of the doctors in our film talked about how gender identity dysphoria is caused by all of these other things that can be happening, such as autism, trauma, abuse, mental and, you know, depression. So I feel like you're saying a lot of these, even though you were a little bit older, you're in your 20s, right? Mm-hmm. But it's still very similar to what they were saying about children. So once you started on testosterone, what changes did your body go through as you started taking it? How did it make you feel?
It took maybe a few weeks before I started seeing changes. Initially, my voice started to change. I sounded like a teenage boy. I mean, I still kind of do sometimes. I'm sort of stuck in this place where my voice will like crack. Mm-hmm. And I sound goofy, but it was really bad when it first started, where it would just crack all the time. I had a lot of acne. My hairline eventually, after a few months, it did start to change, which was kind of the shocker for me. I would say the initial changes of the acne and the voice changing and my TMI, but my genitals did change. Mm-hmm. Those changes I could kind of deal with, or just sort of separate. But then once my hairline started to change, that really like shook me.
And what do you mean? Like, how did it shake you? Like, was it like you were excited this was happening, or you were like, wait a second, am I doing the right thing? Like, what do you mean?
I actually got wildly depressed. I talked to the gender therapist about it. And I told her, you know, I'm having a lot of doubts. This does not feel right. I don't recognize myself anymore. And when what I see in the mirror doesn't look like it's supposed to look, this doesn't feel good. And her response was that doubts are normal. It's perfectly fine for you to feel this way, but you just got to push through because it's just going to get better.
And how long had you been taking the testosterone at that point when you voiced those doubts to your therapist?
Maybe like 2 or 3 months.
Okay. So pretty quickly, pretty quickly. And yeah, that was my next question. Did you meet resistance or were supportive when you kind of started telling your doubts? And it sounds like you kind of met resistance. Did you have anyone in your circle, like kind of hearing you or that you felt like was really listening to you?
No. So in the circle of other transgender people that I was in, there's a lot of peer pressure. And it was, you know, when I look back, it was incredibly unhealthy. Those relationships were very toxic because we were encouraging each other to do surgeries that could cause us harm and go with, you know, go on hormones that could cause us harm if we didn't have the correct information about our medical history. And things like that. And it was just, you know, go for it. It's going to make you feel so much better. Your life is going to be perfect after this. And it just, the peer pressure, you know, unfortunately, as old as I was at the time, it still really affected me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, in our 20s, we're still, even in our 30s, I think we're still, you know, I think we finally start to understand, but yeah, you're still really young. Your brain still isn't even fully developed yet, right? So regardless of how you felt and your voice concern, you decided to stay the course. You thought, she's right. I will get better. I will get through this. So you stayed the course for how long?
So I stayed on testosterone for 5.5 years.
Okay. What kind of effects did you see on your body through that time?
I lost a lot of weight. I became very underweight and I lost a lot of muscle mass and my voice continued to change. I continue to have like some skin issues. I still to this day have skin issues. So that's just an ongoing thing. And then near the end of when I was taking testosterone, right before I decided to stop, my kidneys and my liver began to fail. And at the time, I was not on any other medications. This is going to be part of the graphic information. <okay. laughs> I was completely jaundiced and I started urinating blood and vomiting blood. And I couldn't even stand up most days. I became very sick and my doctor said I needed to be hospitalized. And so I was about to be hospitalized, but she said, before being hospitalized, why don't we take the testosterone out of the equation and see if that helps? So I did, and it did. It helped. The jaundice eventually went away. I went on some special medications and supplements and special diet, and eventually things got back to normal.
Wow. And how's your health now, if you don't mind me asking?
My health has been severely affected by this. I have had endometriosis, which kind of came out of nowhere. No family history of it. No indications early on. Usually there's indications when you're like a teenager and in your 20s. Right. I had no indications and it just sprang out of nowhere. I've had vaginal atrophy that's so severe that it continues to tear and bleed. I'm now so low on estrogen. My doctor says it's lower than a woman going through menopause. So I actually now permanently have to go on supplemental estrogen.
And in your research and talking with others, is this something other people also experience or?
A little bit. The endometriosis, maybe it's just a grudge. So I don't know. I have a huge bias. So I don't know for sure if it's tied to the testosterone use or not. And I can't prove that really.
Sure.
But I have talked with several detransitioned women who now have PCOS and many, many women who have issues with their estrogen levels, as well as vaginal atrophy, pelvic pain, pelvic muscle loss, things like that.
So what do you think the role of money or profit has to do with this whole, like, pushing people through this or this transgender ideology in our culture? Because I don't know, I'm skeptical. I talk a lot in my work about big fertility, which I think is taking advantage of women and infertile couples. And I don't know, it feels very similar. Like this is taking advantage of people. It's taking advantage of people and children and vulnerable people. And what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I definitely... From what I know of your work about big infertility, I definitely see the crossover there. And I've thought about that before too. And, you know, I tell people gender dysphoria, which is usually used as a reason for transitioning, you know, gender dysphoria is not the cause, it's a symptom. You know, your discomfort in your body is coming from trauma, abuse, depression, sexual orientation issues, circumstantial issues, the sexism in our culture. Gender dysphoria, I don't think is entirely innate and isolated. So these people who are trying to treat gender dysphoria They're missing the whole point of going down deeper and treating the real root of the issue. And I think there's definitely, you know, I have my own conspiracy theories about who's running the show for the big bucks. But at the end of the day, I think there's a lot of people who are in the middle who are somewhat aware that they're causing harm, but they're encouraged and sometimes even pressured to continue causing harm to an extent where they put their ethics on the back burner and they say, I'm just going to keep doing this because I'm getting encouragement from the public culture. I'm getting encouragement from my training. I'm getting paid more because I'm specializing in this thing. Why would I not go along with it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is really dangerous. I mean, I feel like I've talked with a lot of men and women and it doesn't seem like we can have a civil discourse about this. Like if anyone tries to kind of go against this ideology, then you're just silenced and canceled. And I wonder, are you experiencing that in with detransitioners? Because ultimately you guys are kind of not necessarily fighting that, but you're having a voice that they may not want to hear.
Yeah, I mean, to put it bluntly, I've been in a few interviews that I will not name, but where in huge amounts of time that detransitioners spoke was completely cut. Mm. And, you know, we've constantly been told that because we're a minority, we should not be getting any time to speak. Mm. The irony, of course, is the transgender community is a minority. And the way we grow is by recognizing the places where we fail. Mm. And it's really harmful, not just to detransitioners, but to the people who choose to transition, for us to ignore the harm. Because if someone is given the proper information and they are told about the dangers and they still choose to transition, if they're an adult, I feel that's their choice, but they're not being given that information to start with.
Right. Especially, I feel like young children, right? Like yeah. littles. I'm hearing of like 3 and 4 year olds being transitioned and that just kind of breaks my heart. I'm in healthcare and I feel, you know, the first do no harm. And I feel like we're harming these little ones. We're not fully understanding and we're not explaining risks. And So I agree, you know, it's if you're an adult and you have these kind of, you understand the risks and benefits. But I also feel like the research on this too, even for adults, it's still really lacking, right? Like how can you know? And same for like egg donation in quotes, egg selling. Women aren't really giving informed consent because there's not enough data to show what kind of long-term risks there are. So I feel like it's kind of similar. You know, we're not showing, there's not, the data is mixed.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. The data, so for studies on cross-sex hormones, you really have to go back to like the 80s and 90s to look at any research that's got detailed value to it. Anything after that is predominantly more social oriented. And so it's more asking people within a really short span. Most of these research studies are done involving people who've only been on cross-sex hormones for a couple of years. And they're interviewing them, asking them, you know, how is your life now? And to be frank, you know, you get so much pressure. You get so much pressure from the community and so much encouragement to step into the spotlight and say, this is the best thing I've ever done. That even if there are issues that you're like, well, I don't know if this is the best thing I've ever done, really, there's been some problems. You're not going to talk about that because then you're going to get booted.
Yeah. Why do you think that is? Why is there so much pressure for this to be the answer?
I think a lot of it is involved in misogyny. The ideas behind transgender identity are inherently sexist. The concept that if you're a little girl and you play with a G.I. Joe, you must not actually be a girl is taken very seriously in that community, and it's wrong. And I think that the people who are pushing for that are really holding to this sexist belief. I think they truly believe you can't be a girl and want to be a scientist or a doctor. You can't be a boy and want to be a fashion designer. And those tropes I think have gotten stronger in our society. It's more subtle, where we broadcast that we're so liberated and progressive and we've changed. But I believe we've gotten worse. And so I think that the people who are really pushing for transgender identity are struggling with their own self-acceptance, that, you know, they have likes or dislikes that aren't associated with their sex in a stereotypical fashion.
Wow. Yeah. So you mentioned both already and then through the email, the unethical process by which people are being pushed to transition. Can you give a little more detail there and why you think, or what is so unethical? Why you think it's unethical? What's so unethical? Just for our listeners, just expand on that a little bit more.
Yeah. So personally, like I mentioned, I live with a serious mental illness. Fortunately, I've found stability and found ways to live with this mental illness, but I've had periods where I was very self-destructive. And in those periods, I went and sought help. And when I went to see a gender therapist, that was one of those times when I sought help. Instead of receiving the care that I needed, I was encouraged to alter my body permanently. I feel that's unethical because it could have been done in a less drastic, non-medicalized way. We could have done a lot more talk therapy, a lot more CBT, and other methods that could have really helped me process my issues. Instead, that wasn't even approached as an idea. Mm-hmm. It went straight to, you need to go on cross-sex hormones, you need surgeries. And that seems really wrong, to be encouraging someone who is mentally ill to literally cut up their body. It seems like an abuse of power.
Do you think you would have been open if she would have provided pushback?
That's a tricky thing, because I know a lot of people do ask about that. And the answer is no. And it's hard to tell people to go to push against their clients when they know their client's not going to take it very well. But that's the thing, is instead of looking at it as gatekeeping, we need to look at it as safeguarding.
Right.
Safeguarding is protecting the vulnerable patient and their longevity. Mm-hmm. So being able to look at your patient and say, I'm not going to approve this thing because I don't think it's a healthy choice. Unfortunately, you are going to get a lot of pushback. You're in that client may go somewhere else where they will get approved, and you have to learn to be okay with that.
Yeah. It's your job, right? Like, I'm just thinking of, you know, the opioid crisis and pain medication. If someone who has a known addiction to pain medication goes to the doctor and says, no, I need this, it's the doctor's responsibility to say, well, no, you don't. And to give the unfortunate news and the unfortunate pushback, you know, to keep this person healthy and safe. But so it's kind of a little bit similar, I guess. So what would you say to a listener today who might be curious about wanting to transition? Maybe they're thinking about doing it. It seems like the right answer. Or what would you say to someone who's listening, who's really wanting to detransition, but doesn't have the support and the network around them currently to do that?
To someone who's looking to transition, I would suggest investing in therapy, not gender therapy, but actual therapy, and evaluate your mental health. And do it for longer than 3 weeks, like I did it. I would recommend, honestly, like, it's gonna be hard, because when you're in that situation, you want a quick fix so badly, but you have to learn to be patient. And I think waiting at least a year and being in therapy is really imperative to making sure you're making a good choice. I think also for people who want to transition, you're probably going to be told to not do this, but go onto the detransition websites, go onto detransition message boards like Reddit, talk to detransitioners about their experiences, because a lot of times they'll have more medical insight than your doctor is willing to give or able to give, because a lot of doctors just don't have that information. But people who've lived through it, they can tell you, you know, so many times what they experienced, and that can be beneficial. And for anyone who's looking to detransition, I would say, you know, you've been through a huge trauma. Sorry.
Take your time.
going through that process of permanently altering your body and realizing it was avoidable is it's really hard. Because you want someone to be angry at. You want justice. And you wish you could go back. But the truth is you can't. You can't go back. You can only go forward. And going forward means advocating for yourself, learning to love yourself. You're not probably ever going to fully love your body. And I think a lot more people struggle with that than transgender people realize. That was a big thing for me when I was detransitioning, was talking with other women who had never transitioned and hearing them say that they struggle with their bodies too. And they really struggle walking through this world as a woman, because that is a very particular kind of hell in a lot of ways. But there is strength in numbers. There is strength in community. And there are people who will love you. And your journey through transition into detransitioning will ultimately teach you about how to take care of yourself.
That's really beautiful, Rachel. Thank you for sharing that and being vulnerable. What can people do, society, people who are listening, who maybe this is new territory, they're not super sure how to tread, but how can they support people who are questioning or rejecting their bodies? And how can we support detransitioners? I think sometimes I'm afraid to even reach out for things that I'm uncomfortable with because I don't, you know, I don't want to insert foot in mouth or, you know, but how is there a way that we can support these people and wrap our arms around them and, you know, so to speak?
Yeah. So I think with minors, it's real sticky territory because they're going through the process of self-discovery in a lot of other ways aside from gender things. Mm-hmm. So I think for minors, just being there and being listening, being a good listener is a good way to show support. As for detransitioners who are adults, I would say, and maybe I'm just speaking for myself, but don't be afraid to ask questions. I mean, I've publicly talked about my genitalia more times than I ever thought I would. and it's kind of become old hat now. You know, I mean, it's still, there are still things that I hold private and hold close to my heart, but it takes a lot to make me uncomfortable at this point. And I would rather be able to inform somebody and answer their question as best as I can. So I think asking questions is great. Looking at your state laws is really important too. For those who are in the United States, looking at what is going on as far as transitioning minors is a big thing right now. So mm-hmm. looking at the laws that allow minors to transition without the parents' consent is a big deal right now. A lot of states are going along with that. And if that's something that you disagree with, talk to detransitioners about why they may disagree with it and learn more about their points. And then take that with you into public discourse concerning these things. I find a lot of people are very well intentioned, but they go without speaking to detransitioners first. Mm-hmm. And it's not that it's our way or the highway. Obviously, sure. Everyone has their opinion, but I do think there's a lot of value to talking to people who've lived through this, and not making this just a political statement or speaking on the morality of it when you haven't talked to the victims.
Yeah. Talk about the people who are invested in this and it's affected their every being, every part of their life. Yeah, for sure. And it's encouraging. I see a lot of parents kind of rallying around this too, with this new legislation trying to pass in different states. So are you hopeful that things will become less unethical in this area? Are you hopeful for society and for these laws to kind of stop or?
I definitely have big moments of cynicism where I fall down the hole and I'm kind of like, there is no hope. but then I talk with women who are actually, you know, out there and doing good for the world. I'm like, you know what? No, there is. And I also like a huge misconception that the general trans community likes to say about detransitioners. They like to say that we don't want anyone to transition and we hate people who transition. That's not true. Like I said before, if you're an adult and you have all the facts presented to you, like go for it, do you? But at the end of the day, people are not getting the information they need. And that's where I draw the line is I don't blame the people who are choosing transition at all. I understand where they're coming from, but we really need more research done and more information and more research to make this a healthier choice. If that's something that someone wants to choose, they need to be given the option to do it in a healthy way that's not going to harm them down the line.
Well, we are just about out of time, Rachel. You are a beautiful woman and a beautiful soul. I love talking with you. Do you have anything else that you would like to address or talk about before we kind of say our goodbyes for now?
I just say, you know, anyone who wants to be an ally to detransitioners, like I said before, just reach out. I know it's nerve-wracking in this day and age. You don't want to say the wrong thing. You don't want to offend people, but just take that extra step and just talk to us. We're people.
I love that. We have this fear of the unknown, right? And if we don't, you know, we got to bridge those gaps and sometimes step out and just talk to one another.
Exactly.
Well, it's been a privilege to have you on the show. I want to thank you for taking the time out of your day to chat with me and share your very personal, very vulnerable story with us on Venus Rising. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Of course, of course. I'd like to have you back sometime. I'd like to thank each and every listener and subscriber for tuning in. Our goal, as ever, is to facilitate conversation, create discussion, and encourage you all to think beyond the masses. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.